Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is with Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who's nominated for a Grammy this year. He records every interview and makes sure we sound like angels. So if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In this episode, we have Sean Douglas. Sean just got nominated for Best New Country Song for Die Happy Man, which he co-wrote with the artist Thomas Rhett and our producer, Joe London. He's had hits with Jason Derulo and Fifth Harmony and David Guetta, amongst many others. And that's his forte. I mean, I think people in the music industry tend to pigeonhole songwriters. So when a guy has a number one EDM song and a number one rhythmic song and then a number one country song, that says a lot about how this writer has navigated through the pitfalls of the music industry and how they've established themselves as somebody who can actually make songs that really transcend the genre. Sean is one of those guys who really exemplifies that. So I'm glad we have him as our guest today. As we usually do, we're going to go through a few people you need to know to understand this episode. There's Benetta, who's Julian Benetta, who's a great producer. He's executive produced One Direction. He's now executive producing Hey Violet, who's just about to have a breakout. There's J. Mike, who signed to Dr. Luke. There's Jason Evigan, who we have an interview with in a couple weeks. There's Cara Diaguardi, who is one of the hosts of American Idol. There's Mitch Allan, who's a co-writer of all of theirs. There's Jake Livingston, who is an A&R and used to work with Sean. There's Greg Wattenberg, an A&R guy. There's Katie Wolliver, an A&R girl at Warner Chappell. There's Julia Michaels, who's a prodigy who we've discussed in many episodes and has just released her first single, Issues, which is, I believe, number one on today's hits for Spotify. And of course, we reference Max Martin and Dr. Luke and Benny Blanco and Stargate, which we reference in a lot of episodes because they're sort of part of the super producer class. If you don't know who they are by now, you'll get to know them throughout all of these episodes because everyone's sort of chasing their tails. Benny Blanco, of course, we interview in the first episode, so if you're interested in that one, please go back and check that one out. And again, here's one last note. A lot of people have been asking if they can hear the songs from the writers that we're interviewing. Well, you can. We have a Spotify playlist if you look up And the Writer Is. And if you go to our website, andthewriteris.com, you'll see that list there. So you can follow along with the interview and play whatever songs we're talking about, and you can listen to it afterwards. It'll still be up. So there you go. Here is another episode of And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's guest is one of the most diverse songwriters in the game. His lyrical wit is evident whether he's writing club bangers or country ballads. I don't know another writer who's as humble, considering his mass success. From Los Angeles, California, this guy is not just a songwriter, but a song crafter. And the writer is, who I want to be when I grow up, Sean Douglas.
Yeah, that's a nice intro.
That's what I do. I just butter you up.
Yeah. And then just like all the dirt just comes flowing out.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what I do. Well, why don't you put the mic closer to your face?
Okay. All right. So I sound more manly.
There you go. Because no one's manlier.
No.
Than a couple guys around 6 feet.
Couple guys in skinny jeans.
A couple guys in skinny jeans.
Talk about feelings every single day. All day.
I had somebody once come in a session and they were... some girl was wearing something, and someone in the session said, like, oh, that dress is like fuchsia. And some guy said that. And she goes, I didn't know guys know fuchsia. And it's like, you're walking into a room of guys who are talking about crying regularly.
Yeah, literally, who are professionally sensitive.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
So, good to be here. You know, one of the things I like to do is go back and try to figure out when I met somebody. And this is crazy. I got an email from Jake Livingston on October 27th, 2010.
Okay. That sounds about right.
He says, how are you? Do you want to write with my guy, Sean Douglas, sometime? Sean has cuts with Katie Groves and Heiswa.
And who?
Heiswa? H-E-I-S-W-E? Universal Motown?
And first of all, that's great because that's Jake like hustling and being like, well, I sent this to their A&R and he liked it, so I'm just going to call that a cut.
I had no cut.
I had Katie Groves. That was it.
Right. Yeah. You had worked with Tamar, who was on Interscope. I remember that.
Right.
And then, you know, other writers like J. Mike, Wattenberg, Benetta, Tiesto, and more.
Yeah.
I like the A&R. Those
were like, and more. Then those were like tracks by those guys that like somebody had let me write over.
It was funny because my response to him is, does he have tracks he can send before we book anything?
Reasonable.
You know, like I didn't know. And not, you know, I didn't know who you were. Not that I knew who I was at that point. Like I was still in the band. I didn't, you know, he knew my band. And
right. You were still in the band.
I think so. At 2010?
But you were already doing...
Like, I think I was like, I was finishing... Oh, maybe that was like the very end. I think I played one more show probably around that.
But you had cuts and stuff because I knew who you were. I knew that you were like this, that you were a guy, a man about town.
I was a guy.
Yeah.
I was a guy in town.
Yeah, yeah. You were in the game.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then you sang a demo of mine.
Oh, right.
3,000 Miles.
That you did with John Levine.
Yeah.
That was a really good song.
Yeah, it became an Emblem 3 flop.
Yes, I remember. It was going to be a One Direction. No, it was going
to
be...
Yeah, we went to the UK and recorded them on it. But I just remember him saying, you know, my friend Sean Douglas, you know, saying on this. I was like, oh, cool. I don't know why I didn't cut it, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah, sure.
But like we had some weird like collaboration before we even
knew
each other.
That's true, some remote collaboration.
But I kind of love that. That means that we've kind of known at least of each other for almost 6 years or something, 5.5 years.
Well, I remember when Jake, it was when I cut that and before. I mean, I knew you as like this guy who was like, I just felt like you represented sort of like, actually, I said this to someone. I was like, Ross Golan is like, that's the guy that I'm like, that I want to like do what he does in that like,
really?
I'm not like a... I was like, he's out there. He's like getting cuts. He's a songwriter. I knew enough to know that you were like a somehow like a top to bottom songwriter, and that you weren't like some guy vibing over tracks.
Nice.
And that you weren't a producer or a track guy,
right?
And I was like, that seems like a prototype of like a basic role that I could be.
Sick.
Anyway, and then when he,
I was trying to write that about you. I was trying to figure out how do you describe somebody who's like, well, you're not a producer, and a lot of guys that our writers are producers too. And it's like, you're not a top liner because you play instruments.
Right.
And you can actually write 100% song if you wanted to.
Right. Like I try not to get precious about it when people like certain people get like thorny ones. They're like, I don't appreciate the term top liner. You know,
right.
But like I don't like, it doesn't bother me, but I do think of myself as like, I'm just a songwriter. Like people used to be, you know, troubadour songwriters who would sit down and write a song.
Absolutely.
But then someone can add lasers and you know, 808s too.
Well, I was trying to find some Burn Down the Mission records.
Oh yeah. I've hidden them far away.
Well, you still have a MySpace.
Deep in a bunker. Oh, I do?
Yeah.
You do? wow,
so
really?
Be careful. But anyway, no, I was trying to look it up and I was trying to figure out, you know, what that sounded like, but I couldn't really get anything to play. So what is, you know, you were in a band that was obviously something that you cared about.
Yeah.
How long were you in that?
Well, it kind of was like, that was the last incarnation, the last and most semi-professional incarnation of like a band that I had kind of been in with certain core members since the beginning of college. So I like...
Oh, so it's a Wash U band?
Yeah.
You went to Wash U in St. Louis.
I went to Washington University in St. Louis. A lovely, wonderful place, filled with lovely, nice people. But I went... So I'd been in this band in high school that was called Pseudo Band. It was not a, it was great, just like crappy.
It was called Pseudo Band, not Pseudo. It was no, called Pseudo Band. Yeah. That's pretty, that's clever.
I guess, yeah.
It's probably accurate, too.
Yes, very accurate, yeah. More than we knew. Yeah, it was like just a garage band, whatever. But then the bass player from that was a good buddy of mine. We ended up going to WashU together, and we were like, and I by the end of high school, I'd become like obsessed with the sort of band scene, like the sort of indie pop thing that was happening in LA.
Right.
And I was like, dude, we're going to go to college. We're going to start this band. It's going to be. So basically, like, I had like a mission at the beginning that, like, I'm going to get this liberal arts education and have a nice collegiate experience that is hopefully also collegial, and then do the band thing, and like, and then by the end of that, like, see what was happening. So I had this band called Sidehatch. We added like these two guys, and then eventually changed to this thing called The Hatch later that was like the same thing, but like switched out one guy, and then switched out a couple guys after college and went to New York, and like was this thing called Burn Down the Mission.
So Hatch became Burn Down the Mission.
Yeah.
So you were never going to stay in St. Louis.
It was like a discussion right after, because we liked St. Louis a lot, and like it was kind of a cool market because it's big enough that it like gets big bands coming through, like they have to come through on tour. And we were just sort of like, especially mostly being from LA, we were just like, this is like a small enough pond that maybe we could like focus our efforts here and like be the band like in town,
right?
Which is, you know.
And at that point, there are... you probably graduated like 2005 or something, right? Or
yeah, 2005, yeah.
So then around then you actually had, there's still a place for regional bands to blow up because it's not as homogenized as it is now.
Right.
So there is actually like a place for bands in 2005 to break out of a St. Louis. It's much harder to do that now.
Like as I was saying that just now, I realized how like kind of antiquated that idea is, like that we would like own this like scene.
Right.
Like that even is like not even relevant to how a band does anything now, I don't think, for the most part.
Right.
But anyway, we didn't do that. And we like went to, we kind of came home and regrouped in LA and then went to New York a little bit after that and did kind of a stint there for 4 years.
How long did you live in New York?
4 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
We went to, we like got this like crazy loft in Bushwick, in Brooklyn. And it was
the
like,
whole band.
Yeah, the whole
so
band.
So you guys are living your 20s.
Yes,
like in
just dirt
New York.
Bags. Yeah.
That's the best.
And Bushwick at the time, like now it's, I mean, the writing was on the wall about it, kind of how the gentrification was coming, just because you look around and there are enough like skinny, like malnourished white guys that you're like, I see what's happening here. But like, but it was still early, so we could still like get a loft for really cheap and you could build a mountain. It was just this raw square space. And like we built these crazy cubby holes in the corner.
Right.
To maximize room for like rehearsing and recording, you know, and like,
did your neighbors just despise you? Or
yeah,
is,
yeah, but it was like enough of a like Wild West sort of scene out there that there was only so much they could do. So we built these sort of four, like it looked like if you looked at it head on, it was like Hollywood Squares. So it was like two guys on top, and two guys on bottom, open face, just like curtains in the front. Rickety as hell.
Did you guys communicate with like cans and a string? Between,
We communicated with whispers because you could hear everything.
Right.
You know,
The
women in our lives did not appreciate it.
That's crazy. So, did you guys have a record deal?
No. So then we made.
Were you just playing like whatever New York clubs, like CBGBs at the time, and just doing the circuit,
just doing all that, Webster and then occasional Hall little runs that we would kind of justify and like. You know,
to come to
maybe
LA.
Break even on and like,
You'd come to LA and you'd, because some A&R guy who works for an A&R guy was like, yo, you should come and
well, eventually,
play.
Yeah. So eventually, we would come to LA and we would do like shows and randomly to feel like we were important. And, but, you know, at a certain point I was like, no, I have these batch of songs that like I think sound for the first time like they could be together. Like, so we recorded them as a record and the idea was make this record that is finished and produced and ready to go, and then just shop it as like, hey, record labels, like we're good, we're ready, we got the album for you. You don't have to, all you got to do is pick us up and we'll hit the ground running.
Every band's dream,
right? Of course,
sure.
So we sent it out to like everyone that we know in the music industry once we work on this thing for a while, and it was just like crickets, like nothing came
Why?
Back. I don't know.
Do you listen to it? Have you listened to Burn Down the Mission since I've been a successful
I haven't listened to it commercial songwriter. Recently, but yeah, every now and again, like a track will come on shuffle.
Yeah. What? How do you, because I have so many emotions attached to previous projects that tie up, you know, a lot, just all kinds of things. And when I listen to it, it puts me in a place usually of mass anxiety and frustration. And I still feel like I'm trying to get that record deal.
Right. You know? I feel like that now.
I even had record deals, and I was trying to, or get noticed, or somebody to, like, you know.
Yeah. I have a lot of anxiety about it. Just the way my voice sounded and on it, and like, just. Ugh.
Do you still want to do?
There's some good stuff in there, and I don't want to write all of it off. We worked hard on it, but yeah.
Well, did you ever get those songs cut? Have you ever tried to get them cut by other people?
Not really. There was one that was kind of going to get cut, and then, I don't know, that kind of didn't happen. But yeah, it never really went that way.
We always tried to write songs that no one else could cut. That's what made us, in theory, an artist.
Right.
You know, that no one else could do it. Right. But that put a giant stamp on the catalog of no one will cut your songs.
Yeah, stay away.
Know?
Beware.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, totally. Anyway, we got this email back from a guy like 4 weeks after kind of disseminating this album. And it was this dude, and he was like, hey, it was Jake Livingston. And he was like,
oh, wow.
And he was like, hey, I found your record. Here's who I've sent it to already. Here are my responses. Sure. So-and-so likes it. So-and-so loves it. So-and-so doesn't care. Blah, blah, blah. And it was just like very kind of together and amped up.
So he became, was he the manager
and he was like,
of the band?
Can I keep going? Yeah. And we were like, yeah, keep going. So he kept going, and he drummed up this whole interest, and we ended up kind of showcasing, you know, one label becomes interested, and then all of a sudden, like, everyone wants to just, it's the FOMO thing, and so we showcase for everybody, and then it kind of started slowing down at a certain point where it was like, this isn't really going to pan out, or whatever deal might come out of it isn't going to be, like, a really good one.
Right. Yeah, but did you know that? Because, I mean, that was one of the things that we've mentioned, because a lot of people that we've talked to have been in bands that, you know, you get this record deal and you split it five ways.
Yeah.
And it's $100,000.
Yeah.
And minus your manager's fee and everything else, you walk away with groceries for a third of a year.
Totally.
But did you know that's like that's the deal? Or at that point, are you thinking, you know, if you get a record deal, that's the stepping stone to serious money?
Honestly, we were wise enough to, and had been around, heard enough stories to know that, like, yeah, like, a lot of record deals are really crappy, terms aren't great, and especially, you know, for new bands, and the money goes like that. But I think I probably would have taken, I'm kind of putting like a more professional sounding slant on it than it really was, like I probably would have taken whatever.
Yeah,
just because it would have, more because we had been, I felt like we were at the point of no return as far as music, and I was like, I've spent too much time doing this to do anything else.
Sure.
And go back and start some other career path, which may or may not have been true. But
and were some of these songs at that point on the album? Are you carrying songs from Pseudo Bam through Hatch?
No.
Were new
this
songs,
all new, stuff.
This
was
new material.
Yeah.
So you're growing as a writer in this process.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But still had not. So anyway, as this started to wind down, Jake, I was like, or I said, like, will you just like keep me busy and put me in some writing sessions? And then I started to kind of. That's when I also moved back to L.A., or was around the time that I was moving back to L.A., and put me through the sort of blind date crazy
thing. That when you met, because he manages Mitch Allan, I don't know if he always did, is that how you met them for Heart Attack, for Demi?
No, or like, that was after, like, it took definitely a year, more than a year, because I did a year of writing. I didn't meet those guys till later. He wasn't managing Mitch at that point. Like 2 years after that, and Katie Wallover put me in that session.
Yeah, Katie's great.
She was awesome. But that was like, I had already had the Katie Groves stuff that came out and kind of came and went.
Did you have a single?
Yeah, I had a single. So it was like I had one real cut, and it was a single.
God,
so
that's amazing.
Yeah.
It took me a lot of cuts to get to a single.
Well, so that was the other thing that I used to think about you, because I thought about you later as I started getting things. Like, I would get not a lot of cuts as far as volume. I would get very few.
Yeah.
But my first, like, three cuts were all singles.
Yeah.
Which was a weird thing.
Incredible.
And you were getting tons of cuts, but I was always like, I was like, Rossi doesn't seem to have that many singles, but he's killing it. Like, he's getting cuts. And I was just, man. And clearly a question of when the tipping point would come. And it would,
sure.
You know, Julia, I think, had experienced a similar thing.
Yeah, I think it's rare. I mean, to get most artists write their own. Most artists write their own material, or at least think they can. So they write as many as songs as they can, and for you to get the single, that means that it's a song that they can't write on their own.
Sure.
Otherwise, they're writing it. So to get album cuts is pretty rare, especially now because right. there aren't a lot of them.
Right.
So it makes sense for if you're getting outside songs for them to be focus tracks. Otherwise, they're just releasing their own material.
Right. Otherwise, what's the point? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it makes sense. Why some people are able to get singles right off the bat, because, you know, sometimes whatever that artist is, maybe that artist just writes all their own material but can't write a single, you know?
I guess. I mean, yeah, I think also there's just so much serendipity involved and timing. I mean, that was like Heart Attack. The way Heart Attack came about was so crazy that or it seemed crazy to me, that when it finally happened and materialized and became a hit, it almost scared me more than it relieved me, because I was like, this has to happen. This is the crazy rigmarole that everyone needs to go through for something to get one hit. And we're supposed to have like a string of these.
Yeah.
And it turns out
it's so shocking, right?
It's crazy.
For the people who have 7 hits, they've released 14 singles that year.
Yeah.
So the ratio, if 5% of your songs are getting cut,
right.
You know, they've had 14 singles and probably double that or triple that for cuts. You know, I mean, not really, but
no, totally.
If you're for you to be the biggest songwriter in a year, you need 4 or 5 singles or something like that. Yeah. That react,
and then a bunch. You're gonna have a bunch on top of that that really don't.
That don't.
Yeah, it's crazy. How not up to you it is. You know,
I mean, the realization of a guy in a band who realizes, oh yeah, you can have singles. You know, you write with Katie,
yeah,
and it becomes a single, and you have to be kind of shocked, because here you are sending. You know, you've been in a band for 4 years at this point in New York, trying to get a record deal, and then you write it. One of your first cut is a single, and it had to just. Did it just immediately put the kibosh on your
the band?
Banding?
Yeah, because I think I was already, by the time that really came around, I was like, I think I was out already of the band thing. Because even just the co-write thing kind of already put me in that mind space. Right. And there was so I was already kind of, once I started doing that, like the first few sessions like that, and I was like, oh, we can write this for a girl, or we could write this like
anybody.
Yeah, I could write for you know, I think I wrote over one of these J Mike tracks early, and it was like the super R&B thing that I could never do. And I was like, song wasn't that, nothing happened with the song, but I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. I was like, this is me. Cause that was always one of the big problems for the band thing, was like, I could never pick a thing. Like, we had a country song on the record.
Right.
We had, you know, it's like,
it's hard to be an artist. You have to choose.
It's really hard.
You know, you have to choose to be an artist. You have to do a series of paintings and let it be that. Or you're filming one movie and each song's a scene or whatever it is.
Yeah.
When you're an artist, you want to be a writer when you're an artist.
Yes.
You know, and those are not the same thing.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of burn down the mission.
Yeah.
And you go in, and at this point, this is like 2010?
This is 2010, yeah.
Okay, so then Heart Attack is probably pretty close to that and becomes a top 5 song, right? I don't know when that was.
Yeah,
was that
Heart Attack probably came out 2012. And that was like 3 radio, which is like, to me, at the time, was just insane.
Sure.
Yeah.
Still is.
I mean, still is. I don't know why it sounded so jaded there.
No, but I mean, it is. Look. And that's what's so crazy about it, though. I mean, that song still gets played.
Yeah.
You know, there are songs that went number one that don't get played as much as that song gets played now.
It
has longevity. And I wonder, is that, is that because of how unusual that arrangement is?
That would be nice if that were the case. I hope so. I mean, I really am actually proud of that song, because I really like, it was fun to write with those guys, with Jason and Mitch and Nikki Williams. And, But
it was her single first, right?
Well, They passed on it. Yeah. Oh, right. So the way it happened was we wrote together. So I had a session with Mitch Allen. Right. This is how it was booked to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, Mitch Allen, like, because I knew that name and
SR-71.
SR-71. Right. And he was having a bunch of cuts and had hits. You know, he had the Bowling for Soup hit. And I was like, he works with Kara, you know. So we went in and then Jason was there with him. And I was like, at first I was very like put off, like, who's this guy? They didn't tell me this guy was right. going to be in the session.
Very suspect. Yeah. See? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry.
Like semi-obscure production team wordplay. This is the most like inside baseball thing
yeah,
ever.
Right.
But I love it.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be with Nicky Williams, but then they called and they were like, hey, Nicky is not feeling well.
Right.
She's not going to make it. But write something for her. Here's the general style.
Right.
And then we...
And none of you guys... I mean, Mitch Allen had the Bowling for Soup song, but for the most part, as outside songs go, you know, none of you guys really had anything...
No, like, huge, huge
nothing
things.
Like that.
I guess 1985 was a really big song. I mean,
that's a big song.
Yeah. So Mitch... Yeah, anyway, so...
Mitch aside, but you and Jason...
Had nothing. Nothing. So then... Yeah, Jason had this start of a melody, and we started an idea, and then all of a sudden they call and they go, "Okay, she's coming," and we're like, "What?" And they're like, "Yeah, she's walking up." So all of a sudden, Nicky Williams walks in, and she's like, sunglasses on,
hot mess, yeah,
and she's great. She would fully like she would, she's a self-described hot mess, I think.
Yeah.
But she comes in and she's like, "Oh, I'm so fucking hungover," and just goes and like collapses in the corner. And it's just like launches into this thing about, I can't even remember what the exact story was, the guy she was with the night before and one guy that she's like kind of like toying with and not really into, and another guy that she is into but keeps fucking it up with,
right.
because she's so into him. And then obviously we write the song like that. Anyway, ended up not being her single. They passed on it. Because her team are a bunch of criminal lunatics,
wow,
keep that in. They passed on it. Then Pia Toscano cut it a year later, and I was like, "Oh, thank God!" She's great voice. She sounded amazing on it.
Yeah.
And then they dropped her, and then I was like, "Okay, it's done." I forgot about it, and then somebody else I think was going to cut along the way, and then I just got a call from. Jason was like, Demi is recording it with us right now, and she wants to change this one line in the verse.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I had no idea she was even cutting it. Anyway, it was great, and it came out. But it's just, like, such a windy path to anything coming out. And that was, like, there was, like, a span of a year and a half, you know, between when we wrote it.
Do you think that that's – is that common for your records to be cut by multiple artists?
There have been a couple, recently. There's more stuff like that, I think.
It sort of shows the value of a good song, too. I mean, that...
Yeah.
If you write a song that's good enough, there are a line of artists that would kill for it.
Yeah, yeah. And so I always get a little bit... the ones that really react, you tend to get people, multiple parties, interested.
Right, right. And it's a weird balance of trying to find, you know, is this... best for the song or is it best for the artist? And you know, you want an artist to cut it who's really passionate about it. You know, you don't want an artist who, just because they have a following, doesn't mean it's going to be a big song, you know?
Right. Yeah, so, no, totally. And so great, like, who's the biggest, hottest artist, but does that song necessarily even like
make sense
for them?
Right. It's weird when you have that control, but that's sort of the value of what you
do. Yeah. I'm always scared of those decisions. Yeah.
So you went from being, you know, Heart Attack for a guy in a band kind of makes sense. It's kind of a rock record.
Totally.
In so many ways, that's a rock record.
Totally. Yeah. And she was still to me, she kind of is that, you know, she is a very kind of rocky girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She's definitely fulfilling that lane.
Yeah.
But you as a writer go from that to a string of songs that...
Are not
that. Like, you went and did Talk Dirty Wiggle, Hey Mama, these songs that are kind of urban in so many ways, and they're club records, and they're antithetical to everything a guy on piano is supposed to be doing.
Right. Every
how do you
dude from like Brentwood private school?
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think I'm a diverse writer. I don't have that ability to write really organic club records. And somehow when you do it, you're doing it feels so organic. Yes. How are you doing that? You're not at a club. I can't I cannot see you in front of
I've been there for research, like with pad and paper. Just like
nobody's giving you bottle service. There's nobody like walking up to Sean Douglas with streamers or whatever,
you
like
you don't
sparklers.
Know me, man. I got a whole alter ego.
Yeah, I'm sure you and and Rachel are waiting in line at at whatever or voyeur. I don't know.
We don't even know what the club. Yeah, I was just about to reference some of those, like some club that probably is not as in existence.
Oh, for sure that place is not in existence. Yep. But how do you do that? How are you channeling this weird, like, 25-year-old, you know, urban
like,
voice?
I guess because I've always been, like, kind of an R&B leaning fan, hip-hop, R&B stuff, and I'm just a genuine fan of it, and, like, R. Kelly is, like, one of my favorite artists ever, and and you know, I love that music. So I try and do it like I don't ever want to. I mean, first of all, there's like what you said, kind of urban sounding. Like that's a good way to describe it because like I'm not going in there doing like really, you know, I'm not doing like Future records,
right? You didn't do Post Malone,
right?
Right.
Yeah, much to my chagrin, but
right.
But it's that kind of playful middle ground where you can sort of mine some of that. It's the rhythmic phrasing and the like, and the sort of like tongue-in-cheek, like, you know, provocative sort of wordplay stuff. That's like the part of it that I can draw on better. Not necessarily like the ultra authentic, you know, street shit is not me. I'm not doing that. But yeah, my favorite thing is like a guy who can do a song that's funny and not a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
we were saying that the difference between clever and funny is huge.
Yeah, like Randy Newman is like one of my favorite songs. Randy Newman and like R. Kelly, like those guys.
Yeah.
Although R. Kelly, certain songs, like I heard a couple on the new record that like you're like, that's close to a joke. But I mean, they're not bad, but they're like just silly, way sillier.
Yeah.
Whereas other stuff is just funny but sick, you know, funny but like, oh, that's still awesome, you know.
Where does that come from? Is that, you know, where did you learn to listen to? I'm assuming that you can throw in the Elvis Costellos and you can throw in the Tom Waitses and anybody who's, you know, a witty lyricist. Was that something that you've always grabbed onto, or was that something that you were sort of trained? Did somebody push that kind of material on you? Because that takes effort.
You mean the lyrical stuff?
Yeah, to listen to lyrics takes a certain effort. Were you listening to Biggie, you know, and Tupac, or were you listening to...
I was listening to... You know, I mean, everyone says I listen to everything, but I kind of do.
Yeah?
And did, and I was really into... You know, I was into like all the like, but like mainstream hip hop, like not, you know, Biggie and Tupac and stuff. And then like Beatles lyrics. And like, I'm trying to think of what the really early, like lyrically kind of interesting stuff was that I was into. But it was always kind of the good stuff. I loved the band and kind of a whole. Yeah. I mean, that's like a more than concept records. They're like, that's like a concept band, you know, which I always thought was cool.
Yeah.
And like Tumbleweed
Not
Connection.
Not the pseudo band, but the actual band.
Yeah. Tumbleweed Connection by Elton John is like one of my favorite records of all time, which is just this crazy thing with like this. Yeah, I mean, obviously Bernie Taupin wrote the lyrics, but you know, a Englishman, gay Englishman, piano player doing a concept record about like the American West.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Is a crazy lyrical endeavor.
Is that where Burn Down the Mission comes from Elton John?
Yeah, there's that song, Burn Down the Mission, which is a great song.
Yeah.
And sounds like an emo band when you say it later. Like anything that sounds like a sentence or a fragment of a sentence.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Sounds super emo.
So you go from, Talk Dirty becomes a massive hit.
Yeah,
I mean,
that was
of
crazy.
All the songs that you've had, that's an international smash.
Yes.
So how does that change your life? In a... in a way that before that, Heart Attack's a really big song, big artist. You've had cuts with big artists, but then Talk Dirty comes on and
changes everything for sure. I mean, Heart Attack changed was a really significant change in that you didn't have to beg to get in rooms with certain artists or writers. Like, not like you could get in anywhere, but you could get in a lot of places that you couldn't before. And like A&Rs were taking note, and it's just like it was a good momentum to capitalize on. But so then I got in the room with Jason Derulo like one or two times, and then I had another one. I think I'd only been in once, and it kind of went pretty well. He was clearly like crazy talented. But had been working for a long time. At the time, you know, he'd been kind of doing songs. And even, like, to other writers, like, I'd be like, yeah, I'm doing Jason Derulo. And I was really excited. People were like, he's been, they always say they're going to do something. They probably never put something out.
Right.
Just one day I was going in and I asked Evgen to join because he was around and he's great and fun. And he came in and, they played the Talk Dirty beat. And, like, I think I had heard that we had heard the Talk Dirty beat before, and it seemed like cool but so crazy that we didn't really know what to do with it, or we like tried some start of an idea and kind of aborted.
Yeah.
And then we just like played it a few times. We kept laughing. Kept laughing when it came on because it was so absurd.
Right.
We're in the house of Ricky Reed, you know, who produced the track so wonderfully. Then we just started, we're just like, that's fun. Like, let's just do it. So we just messed around and wrote it. And it was really, that was the opposite of Heart Attack, super fast, you know.
Right.
Like, by the end of the session, you know how it is at APG. I love it over there, but guys come in at will. You know, they come in whenever they want to come
Other
in.
Other people have written on that track at that point. Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm saying, like, A&R is like, we'll come in and check in on what you're doing. There's no, like, excuse us, we're, you know, being artists and but by the end of the session, like, four guys like on the A&R staff had come by, like, we heard about what you guys are doing.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, okay, this is what it feels like to have something that is really, really going.
Yeah. You know? That's pretty cool. So everyone there was pretty, they knew that there was something special.
Yeah.
But even then, when it, you know, they went with Marry Me Second and Talk Dirty is like an international song, and that's the reason why it went here, was that because
it was going so big internationally
they weren't going to go with it here.
No.
And then it ends up being like this smash because the rest of the world wanted it, which I guess in theory is what's going to happen with Get Ugly, right?
Well,
international really wanted it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what drove the U.S. to play. That's yours too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful if that happened.
Yeah.
You know, you really never know. Whereas the Heart Attack opened certain doors, Talk Dirty was like, blew everything up.
Everything open.
Yeah, and just made it, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't have the keys to the kingdom, but it just made it easy. Like, hey, I'd love to do this with so-and-so. Like, that could be arranged.
Did you know that Spin Magazine put Levels at number 11 for pop songs?
Somebody told me that the other day. That's crazy. Cool.
That song is one of those songs where, you know, the song stands on its own.
Yeah.
Previous to any artist.
Yeah.
And it could have gone to a number of people because it was so strong. I'm sure there were options.
There were options for that one. Yeah.
What happened to that versus, because that, if I heard that as an A&R ear, I'd be like, yeah, that's a hit. Like,
yeah.
Let's put whoever on it.
Sure.
You know, what's the difference? Because I'm sure there are songs that you've had that have been successful that you're like, I don't know if I would have thought this was going to be as successful as it turned out to be. And then you go to something like Levels, which I'm assuming you are sort of surprised, because I think anyone who knows that song in the process is sort of surprised that it didn't top out top five, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was so good.
Yeah, that was weird.
Do you know why?
It's been discussed a lot. It's strange because it was so... No, I don't know why. The short answer is I don't know why. I think that you could go at it... I mean... There was like research at a certain point, like the radio research.
Sure.
You know this game better than I do, but like the a certain amount of weeks in, you know, where it didn't, they research a certain, they do call outs, you know, and they, yeah. and they call people at home, which still is amazing to me yeah. that still happens.
Right.
I'm not even saying it's a bad practice. I just think it's crazy. It sounds yeah. like
it's so archaic.
It sounds like it's like the 50s. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. They're calling and there's like somebody in the apron opening the oven and pulling out a pie.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The father answers, he's got a pocket protector. He answers, he's got a comb over. Right. He's just like,
right. Exactly.
Hello.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Douglas residence.
Yeah. Yeah. Pies are cooling on.
Yeah.
The
you're right. Right. Right.
Yeah. Milkman has just left.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so anyway, and I guess the research on this snippet of the song wasn't amazing. Like, the whatever they were getting back was not amazing. But then it was, oh, they kind of used a strange snippet, which I don't know how you find a strange... I think if you're researching sure. a song, why wouldn't you just play the chorus?
Right.
But...
So is the label then pissed at the people who do the research, or is it the label who does the research? Or is it the radio stations and then the... I mean...
I don't know.
I'm bad
with
it. Do you know how any of that works?
Honestly, I know... Like, the way I just described it to you is yeah. about as much as I know about how right, that right. process works. So much of it is a mystery to me.
So you have, you know, right now you have a bunch of songs on the chart. Are you looking, are you constantly obsessing over chart positions? Do you check charts yeah. every day?
There was a period when I was really excited recently where I had three songs in three different formats right. on the radio. And I was pumped about that because I was like... This is cool. This represents
Die Happy Man.
Die Happy Man. Levels was on top 40 and Zero with and Chris zero. Brown was on Rhythmic.
Right.
And was and did fine at Rhythmic. We got to like 8 or something. You can see him like still like kind of like trying to justify and be like, yeah, it did pretty well. Okay. Like, if yeah. you're okay about it. But like, I was excited because I was like, that's who I want to be as a songwriter, a guy who has top 40 song, a rhythmic song, and a country song. It's like, that's cool to me. If I can find a way to set myself apart from the masses of people trying to write
for
pop
sure.
songs, that'd be great. So yeah, I checked a lot during that period, but like, yeah. I still check. I'm checking with Die Happy Man, which Joe London, who's in the room right now, wrote with me and Thomas Rhett. Cause that's doing really well. So I wish I would check less, to be honest.
Right.
Like, I don't check obsessively, but like Hey Mama, which is a total surprise to
sure.
me, the David Guetta song, I didn't check at all because I was like traveling a ton over the summer.
Right.
And every time I'd come home, I'd hear it on the radio a little bit more. And I was like, oh, it was like this nice surprise.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of kept going.
Sure. I mean, the licenses on that song made it impossible not to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, the radio was one thing, but that song was in. I remember, I think I texted you. We went and saw some movie, and there were three previews, and two of them, the theme of right. the previews were Hey Mama. I was surprised there wasn't any exclusivity.
Yeah.
That song was just like, it was like, and the credits, and for previews, I mean, it was like the movie's hinging on an identity, and two of the three are using the exact same song, and it sounded like it was a joke.
Right,
like,
right,
this is a parody.
Right.
You know.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, I'm very bad at gauging what's like a very syncable song. Like, I would have thought, I mean, Talk Dirty got a lot of stuff, but like, not nearly as much as I would have thought.
Yeah.
And then Hey Mama just got a ton. And
yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I don't know.
I'm surprised. This is your interview, not mine. But there's a song that I have that's the Andy Grammer song, Good to Be Alive.
Which I love.
Is licensed 10 times more than the Selena Gomez.
Sure, yeah.
You know,
see that
not
makes...
because not because the song's better or worse, and maybe there's, but it's just interesting that here's a song that's pushing, trying to get into the top 40 of radio.
Yeah,
and you know, here's a song that's at the top of top 40, and the one that's at the top, it's a pop record, so it has to, you know, maybe it'll be a party scene or something like that, right, in a movie, but nobody's choosing that, and it's also not that kind of lyric, but
yeah,
it's sort of a surprise. Well, Hey Mama ended up being the top of the
but the
charts.
Andy Grammer one, yeah, that ended up doing that, but the Andy Grammer one actually makes sense to me, because it's like the lyric is a positive, whereas Same Old Love, right, is I mean, yeah, yeah, kind of negative.
Yeah, negative, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, it's good to be alive right about now. That could sell a car, that could sure, sell coffee, that could sell, right, a lot of things,
right.
And that's really what it's all about. Just
yeah,
advancing
tool,
corporate America's agenda, yeah, as far as possible. And, you know, sure, whatever pennies they throw us in the process, yeah, we'll just
do
laugh.
Do you finish
just
songs
up
with artists where you say, do you ever catch yourself saying this is really singable?
Yeah. But unfortunately, I feel like I say that when I'm not sure that the song is like a hit.
Right.
Like, super singable.
Right,
like always, exactly, has like with that intonation.
Well, because you want to like still put it on the record, because
yeah,
you know it's not a single.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're right, like, man, they could. Man, this is going to be in every. Format. This is going to be in every wedding.
Yeah,
this
could totally. You would sell a shitload of Kias with this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's real. Okay, so then I know you, I want to go to Die a Happy Man, but before that, you had a single with Madonna.
I did.
I mean,
that's cool, huh?
That's kind of an epic, like, thing to put on your Wikipedia.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Did you meet?
We wrote it with her.
You wrote it with her?
Yeah, she's a really good writer. I mean, that's a perfect example of, like, they were collecting sort of inspiration for her record. And they were like, what songs are you into right now? And we're going to put you in the rooms with those writers. She was like, that Talk Dirty record is cool, or whatever she said.
So then you and Jason end up inevitably being intertwined because you guys have had
We've had two hits together.
So yeah, then people then automatically just say, oh, let's get Sean and Jason together.
Yes.
Which is convenient because you guys are actually friends. And
we have
well,
a great vibe, and he's the sweetest man on the planet and crazy talented. And,
right.
And it works out great. It would be terrible. Yeah. If I'd had a couple of hits with some,
when you say
asshole,
works out great, I had an image of him like pumping iron. Like, you're like, dude, he's really good, sweet man, very talented, works out great. You're like, what does that have anything to do with?
Great spotter.
Oh man. Dude, he can lift 150 pounds. Like, I don't know if that's a lot.
Right.
I have no gauge.
Two song writers, like, don't know what a lot to bench is.
Right. Right.
Right. Bench is like 600 pounds. What?
Sure. Yeah. Could be anything. But.
That was funny. Yeah, so that's true.
Yeah.
And that's been wonderful. Anyway, so Madonna said that. They put us in with Evan Bogart, who's also the best. And we get there, and I've never been more nervous for a session ever. And it's not even like I was a huge Madonna fan. I mean, I'm a fan of, a very respectful right, fan of her, everything she's done, and some songs I think are incredible.
Sure.
But I've never been more like shook up. And I go in and they're like, okay, Madonna's gonna be here in 3 hours. Here's how this works. You guys start some ideas.
Right.
And then she's gonna come in and check them out. She was like, start multiple ideas because she's really cutthroat and really just says, no. And that's right, it, and move on to the next one. And, and then she goes, we go, okay, should we demo it or what? And then she goes, I said, have the idea ready to go on for like a demo playback, like a drum track, light drum track and
sure,
vocal, whatever. Also be, sometimes, someday she wants to hear it on guitar, so be ready to play it on guitar. And then someday she wants to hear it on piano.
Sure.
So be ready to do that.
Right.
So she comes in and like we play this song to her.
She's like, I wanted to hear it on drums. Like, yeah, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah. Yeah, she was like, where's the bassoon? Bring it out.
Right.
We just like three like, well, so she's great. The thing that's intimidating about her is not her so much as it is like the team and the entourage.
Right.
Like right, you get a countdown before she comes in, and they say, like, somebody sweeps through the room, or they say, we'll give you a countdown so she won't just like sneak up behind you. And they're like,
also
all of a sudden,
a great image.
Yeah. So we work for a little while. Yeah. And all of a sudden, like, people sweep through the room, team members that you didn't even know existed. And they go, M and 10. And then, like, the lights are dimmed to, like, the perfect vibe dimness. The eucalyptus scented humidifiers start wafting from corners of the room.
Sure.
The truly the greatest smelling candles on planet Earth are lit like everywhere throughout.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And all of a sudden you're like in this like vibe land. And then she comes through with like some handlers. And she's one of us. She says, "Hi, you can call me M. What's up?" And yeah, she's great. And we wrote this song and sang it to her like in unison. I mean, we sang the chorus or whatever we had at that point. Sang it to her in unison. She was like, "That's good." And then we wrote the rest of the song with her, and she's a great writer. Like, has very particular kind of point of view, and it was really fun. Crazy. Not like a commercial success, but a good like.
No, but there's a level
thing,
of
a
like,
good thing to have.
How successful does a song have to be to feel like it was a success?
Yeah,
you know, like "Wiggle" is a success.
Sure,
it didn't go number one.
It did not,
but it's still a success.
Yeah.
You know, and in a lot of ways, Levels is a success. If you can get any song out at all, your iTunes is filled with songs that are not ever going to come out. Not you in particular, all songwriters. But so to have something actually come out, that's a success. And then to have a Madonna single, that's successful.
Ridiculous. Yeah, no, things that I never would have thought possible. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so then your biggest song is probably happening right now.
Do you think that's true? That'd be fucking cool.
I think this is, you know, the last time a song, country record, this is Thomas Rhett, Die Happy Man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the last time I saw a song chart like this on iTunes for this long, it was number one at Billboard for 17 weeks.
Which song are we talking
Girl
about?
Girl Crush.
Interesting.
It was number one at Billboard for 17 weeks. Because of the influence it was having on the rest of the industry.
Right.
And I know that had some political ramifications, that song, that Die Happy Man doesn't have.
No, that has, Girl Crush has a good, like, paradigm-shifting sort of thing to it, which is great.
But Die Happy Man has the crossover ability that hopefully it'll have. But I think as far as, you know... Talk Dirty is a big record. There are a lot of people on it. There's a big sample. It's a different thing than Die Happy Man, which has three writers.
Yeah.
Thomas Rhett, you, and some other guy.
Yeah, some other schmo.
I'm just kidding. Joe London, who's
Joe
sitting
London.
To my right. But,
very
you know,
handsome
you,
man.
That song has the ability to be, you know, I don't know how, seeing the reaction it's having, I don't know how this isn't that kind of song that gets you every country award or nominated.
Oh, wow.
Least.
That's very...
Like, I think you'll... Yeah, knock on wood, but, you know, you don't see songs reacting, you know, Cruise for Florida Georgia Line reacted like that on iTunes, and Girl Crush reacted like that, and this did. I mean, I can't think of, you know... Even Automatic and some of these really big records in country don't really react like that on a full commercial scale. What does it feel like in the middle of this? Are you able to enjoy that kind of success, or does it give you anxiety wondering where it's going to go, or is it totally irrelevant in your daily life?
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on it. First of all, that's cool to hear that from you, because I think that you get the sort of overall landscape better than pretty much anyone, because you have a foot, you have country number ones and a foot in that world, and also do, you know, you have something that's probably going to be a number one soon in pop, like, and you also know the business of those two sides better, I think, better than I do. So that's cool to hear. I mean, I don't know. I was just thrilled to have... Okay, when Joe and I were with Thomas on the bus writing the song, it was the first day, and started. You know, they started like 10 in the morning. We were just like bleary-eyed, roll it out of the bunk. But one of the conversations we had right off the bat was like, it's great writing. I mean, personally, I had been feeling like super proud of Talk Dirty as silly as it sounds and Wiggle and Hey Mom and like it's great and all those songs are wonderful, but at a certain
point they're not emotional in a way that
definitely and when you're you know dad is emailing your aunts and uncles every day about songs that are going on the charts. At a certain point, you want one to be like, feel like, not that the, sure. feel like it might last for a little bit and feel like it might have an emotional, somebody said the at a certain point, like, well, what are your goals? Like, what do you want to do in the next, you know, couple of years? And it was so weird to not have an answer for the question or take a second to have an answer for the question, because it was like, well, like, you're just chasing, all you are thinking about is chasing hits all the lot, or at least I am.
Right.
And I feel kind of mercenary and cold saying that, but it does.
Sure.
That's the kind of business you're in, especially when you're not getting production fees and things like that.
Yeah.
You got to get hits. But at a certain point, when does that like cease to be satisfying? And I thought, well, why are you doing this? And like, you want something to last. We're all into the idea.
Copyright versus the song.
A copyright, right. An evergreen or whatever. I'm not saying this is that, but it is
something.
No, but
it feels like it's becoming that. It's certainly in that genre, you know. I mean, somebody said that they heard Compass on the radio this week, and I was surprised because I haven't heard it since it was on the charts.
Uh-huh.
It's not really like a copyright. It's a number one song in country, but it's not a copyright.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how this song isn't going to be, you know, some of those like Rascal Flatts songs or some of those songs that continually get played 5-10 years from now. It just feels like it's leaning towards that.
Right. Well, we said we want to write something that could be a wedding song, and not just like, I mean, nothing against these songs, but not like a song, not Marry Me or not Bruno Mars, you know, what I think I want to marry you.
That's right.
So yeah, we went out and say, and if it's not evergreen, if something that weaves itself into the fabric of someone's actual emotional real life,
right?
That like they might play at a wedding,
right?
And it doesn't have to be everybody's wedding. It doesn't have to, you know, become some Stevie song,
right?
But it could be mean something to a handful of people. So we did it, and it felt really good. And Thomas played it the next night at his show. Just demanded to. Yeah. He was like, I'm doing it. We were really nervous about
never
it.
Never seen that before.
No.
No way.
When you ever have that.
That never happens.
And we were like, I was like, ugh. And all of my anxiety about like the whole reason I stopped performing and like got into writing was so I could like be in here, craft something until it's finished and can't be fucked with.
Sure.
Can't go, you know, once it's mastered, you know, nothing's going out of tune or getting to like, you know.
Right.
And I was just like, oh God, are you sure? And he went up and played it for like 6,000 people, 7,000 people. And he even like stumbled on certain parts, and I freaked out, but he didn't matter because like they didn't know the song, and they were caught up in the moment.
Yeah.
So anyway, the fact that it's doing well is awesome, and it's so it's nice and gratifying. It makes me want to write more stuff like that.
Have you seen them? Have you actually seen videos of it being played at weddings? I'm sure you have.
No, but I did like start checking Twitter when it came out, and it was like amazing how for a song that doesn't mention marriage at all,
right?
How much people were saying like, at Thomas Rhett, like my wife and I are getting married in a month, and this is our wedding song. This is our first dance, and that was cool.
Of course,
especially as just like a guy like you who just got married a little over a year ago.
Yeah,
for the listeners, we got married on the same day,
not to each other, but I mean, it's cool. We're in California.
Next time, I'll catch you on the second round.
Right. If things don't work out with Rachel and Jackie,
yeah.
You're my girl.
Was that the dynamic that was going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, how do you stay humble with, right now you have at least one just entered top 50 at radio, so you have three songs in top 50.
Uh-huh.
I might be off one. You might have four.
No, I don't know.
So you have a bunch. How do you stay humble?
I mean, it's pretty easy.
Are you not?
I think it's pretty easy. Well, I mean, there's certainly a large ego component almost that I think is almost necessary for part of it. So on the one hand, it's very easy to stay humble because there's so many people who do it so well, and I'm just talking about the craft of songwriting. Or pop, the craft of pop songwriting. So many people who do it so well and with such success that it's like, you know, I'm just like in awe of those people, and I'm not on that level.
But so you are.
I'm not on that level yet. Yeah, I'm in the game.
That's
very much.
No,
in the,
but
like,
that's what's so crazy about it. And I don't think that. I think if you're the, you know, there's there's the older generation, which I'll throw even like Benny in, who's still very accomplished but has been for 10 years, yeah. You know, even though he's young.
Right.
But, you know, you can say Luke and you can say Max and these Stargate and some of these like one word things, and you already know who you're talking about in the songwriting game.
Right.
But you have as many hits this year as the entire Luke camp. Do you know what I mean? You have as many.
I don't know if that's true.
You have as many singles. You have songs coming up. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, Sugar was big, and they had the Rock City one or whatever it was. But the stuff that you're doing is as competitive and as strong. And I'm just saying, like, you are at that level.
Sure.
But maybe that's sort of maybe that's what keeps you humble, is that you don't really see that you're at that level.
Yeah, I see that I'm at the level in that like I'm playing that same game, and our songs are on the charts next to each other, or at least I see them as they rocket past me and wave.
Yeah.
But totally. I'm like, I have a healthy sort of understanding of how far I've come in the past 5 years, and that it's based on hard work and some talent. Right. But I also feel like I found this weird like lane of musician where I can play but I don't play that well. I can sing but I don't sing that well. And I found this like weird assortment of skill set. And I'm not saying this like self-deprecatingly. Well, I am a little bit, but I'm saying it actually. I'm sort of proud to have found this sort of cross section of my talents that works.
That
for
works,
this. Yeah.
In a professional music sense,
yeah,
100%.
Yeah,
it's hard to do that.
Yeah, I think it is. It took me a long time. You know?
Do you find yourself envious of other people's singles or cuts? Because I know that we're all competitive.
Yours.
But we're all friends. right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Totally. Right. We're all friends, and I think this is and I don't. You know, I guess I don't have a climate of songwriting to compare it to previous to this one. But it does feel like there's a very kind of lovey vibe amongst this sort of current, I mean, for lack of a better word, sort of like
generation.
Or I was going to say like upper middle class kind of group of songwriters.
Sure.
You know, the three of us in the room, Ricky, you know, Jason, Julia, Lindy, Mitch, Sam, Ian, all those guys, you know, and assorted networks. Like there's a good like, everyone celebrating everyone kind of vibe. Like I'm looking up at the Start From Infinity plaque, you know, and all the songs that came out of that. And there's a nice communal sort of thing.
Yeah, you root for them. I mean, obviously you want your own success, but sure. I mean, you know, especially when you hear that there's the competition with a lot of these artists are with your friends. It just is inevitable. And there are times where it's you want your song to be picked over the other guy. And we've all submitted songs to the same project. So when you find out that one worked and yours didn't, you're thinking either, why wasn't I in that session? Or why, you know, or like, I should have a song like that. You're looking in your iTunes to see if you have that song.
Yeah, 100%.
But of course you don't, because that's not really how it works.
Yeah.
You know?
No, 100%. And it's just the sort of the nature of how it is. But yeah, I think it's always going to be like that to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that you've done that there are so few people who have that is that and I have the same aspiration of having impactful songs in multiple genres allows you to have a career regardless of the success you're currently having.
Yeah.
You know, if you can have this base and you can you build this safety net and you build this social network that if you're in a down period, there are multiple people that'll say, you wrote Talk Dirty, Die a Happy Man, you know, so you'll always have a space.
I know
writers who can still say, you know, Genie in a Bottle and still get in a room because you have a copyright. You have a name that you can say, I wrote Halo.
Right.
Forever in the zeitgeist, even if you had a giant dry spell for 5-10 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can still say, I wrote that, and there's going to be someone who's going to say, come on in.
Of course.
You know, and that's something that you're achieving, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I don't know if I'm achieving that, but that's cool. And I think there is something to, like, it's cool to see that you were thinking that way as well. I think there's something to the diversity of songs, or that hopefully, as a writer, I think you're often trying to insulate yourself. I'm trying to, like, I might want to be doing this in 10 years like this.
Right.
But I don't know what I'm going to want to do in 10 years.
Right, of course.
And I'd like to be able to do it for just because I really like to do it.
Right.
Dan Wilson, you know, or Jason and I were writing with Dan Wilson the other day, and Joe and I were writing with Dan Wilson the other day. The greatest guy ever.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to, I would assume, write another song for the rest of his life. And does because he enjoys the craft of songwriting and is truly in love with it, and does it at his leisure. You know?
Sure.
I mean, he seems like he still works hard at it, but does it, he could blow off a week and do whatever he wanted to do.
Right.
And it, so what I'm saying is it's nice to insulate yourself against the sort of the frivolous, or sorry, the sort of capricious nature of the business and technology and all those things, and have a broad array of things that says, like, yeah, this guy's like a songwriter. He's not like a guy who had a sound for a minute, I guess is where I'm going.
I mean, on a personal front, because I know you're, you know, the, regardless of the success of music and whatnot, you've gone through significant life issues. You've had, like, familial issues, and you've had to, like, grow as a person in a way that not everybody has had to go through, you know. Does, how much of that influences the decision on, you know, at least maybe, does it influence how you appreciate things going on? Does it make you want to do other things outside of music because of where you've come from as a human, you know?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, without getting too much into it, my mom passed away the year that I really started getting heavily into the songwriting thing. And that was, I think partially I like needed something to really throw myself into after that happened. And she'd always been like incredibly supportive about all kind of creative endeavors that I had. But so I really like went headlong into the running around, writing a ton of songs, getting a ton of songs out of my system. And that was, you know, that I would say, you know, that was the worst year of my life. While I was sort of giving birth to what became, maybe not, maybe it wasn't like as cleanly as, it was almost this clean though. It was like the worst year of my life followed not directly on its heels, but like maybe that became like a year and a half that kind of went better. And then to followed maybe a year or two later by like the best year of my life. Like I got married, all these things that, and I was a very like, as I'm like an only child and I, you know, had a very, my was not like a spoiled kid, but like was very comfortable and kind of, you know, I'm, I certainly suffer from some arrested development because I was like, I just was. I was always like, I didn't, I just was that kid. Like I was always super shy and kind of like behind on things in, as far as self-awakening and realization and realizing certain goals and going after them in certain ways. So, but then when it did come, it came like bang, bang, bang. Like, like even, you know, relationship stuff was like that too. And like, and so it was like first hit, get married, you know, buy a house. Like those things came all in 1 year.
Right.
And it was only a couple years after like just utter, you know, misery and, you know, heartbreak. And I don't know what analysis there is about that, but that was the way it happened.
No, I mean, that says, I imagine that, I mean, that, but that answers the question. I mean, these, it is, it's hard to pursue a career when everyone in the world talks about how difficult the music industry is and how, you know, it's a pipe dream.
Right.
And you're like, no, this is a career choice and I want to go and I want to pursue it. And something drives us to work every day, even though we know we might not get any, might not make a living, maybe no one hears a song. And there's probably, if it takes a life-changing event to say, no, I'm going all in on this, you know, whether it's to think about something else or whether it's, you know, or it's a realization that you only have a certain amount of time, you know, or whatever it is, you know, it takes something to make you go all in.
Definitely.
You know,
definitely.
So that makes sense.
And,
and it's also really impressive. I mean, you have, you probably had the ability to say, I'm not going to do anything. Like at one point, and you know, if you're saying from your childhood and whatnot, there's probably, you probably didn't need to find the motivation as a human, as you're saying, the arrested development from growing up out here. It's possible that you could have just said, you know what, I'm going to be in this band forever
and be like this deadbeat guy.
I mean, it's,
I guess, I don't, I don't know if anyone would have, I think I would have gotten a pretty good kick in the ass.
Eventually.
But yeah, they're right. I know.
Well, because of your parents obviously raised you well enough that, you know, that you wouldn't feel that way, but they could have not raised you.
Sure. I know people have similar backgrounds who, have gone that way, you know?
Sure.
So, but I was always sort of desperately afraid of that. I didn't want to be that kind of like...
Is that what drives you now, you think?
Yeah. And I'd like to even sort of... It was... Yes. Having success in something, particularly something that was not like Hollywood or... was really important. And I mean, it's obviously entertainment. Like my parents were... When people would ask if I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid, they would just like step in and answer for me and be like, no.
Yeah.
And they were not those type of parents. They were like, anything you want to do.
Sure.
And they would, if I
did
had.
Did you want to do?
No, not at all. But if I'd had some, and maybe I was just influenced by them not wanting me to do it. But no, I actually wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. I wanted to be like a poet and stuff. So
That makes sense. You're sort of a poet now.
So I wrote.
I mean, you are a poet.
The poet of, the poetry of Talk Dirty. it's like, it's like Ralph Waldo Emerson and then. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, not Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's not a poet.
I still got the gist.
Thanks.
I like once you sent me a text, you're like, well, it's not Hemingway or something like that. And I was like,
you wrote
and
back
the
in
session.
Very good like, Hemingway in prose.
And the session drew cold. And the writers drew blank, but we sweat through the pain.
Because
then,
they saw that it was a great struggle. And
Well, I mean, I feel like we should end with you playing your medley.
Oh my God.
If we can.
Really?
I mean, we can always cut it till it's right. But
can you comp me and tune me and
we'll comp you and tune my
piano playing in time.
But before we do that, you know, cause we'll go out when that's done, I think, if you're down, but, you know, I always feel like I'm watching most writers I'm really envious of because they either started when they were younger or they were in the, you know, they have a certain level of success or they just have found a stride or they've done something. But I always find myself watching your career as because we have such similar stories that it's impossible not to watch it and feel like I'm either watching there's no other writer I know of that I feel so connected with without being the same human.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, we kind of talked about that before, but that's I've always thought that about you. I mean, yeah, it's strange.
I mean,
when did you come out here first?
Well, I went to college out here, so
right,
I moved
you went
out.
To USC, but,
I moved out.
Did you stay here right after school?
Yeah, yeah, I never left.
Oh, okay.
But I had a record deal in college, so you know.
By the way. How's everybody getting these fucking record deals?
Well,
everyone I work with is always like,
This is the joke of it. Here are two things.
Not like you don't deserve a record deal.
No, no,
clearly you do.
I had a shitty record company in college that I thought I was doing for my senior project. It was my internship. For my internship, I said, can I start a record company? And they said, yes. And essentially, I started my own record company and figured it out and just kept putting imprints on it.
And that was
called Jive Records. Right.
Well, totally, because that's the emblematic thing. That is like the dream. It's just like, if I can get a record deal.
It's all down. It's all uphill.
We've got the whole apparatus at our fingertips and we can do it.
And now when somebody says to you, you know, do you want to work with blank artists? And you say, well, I mean, do they have a record deal?
Yeah.
And
so
they
it say, still actually sort of figures
and,
in even
and
though you know.
And they still say yes and you're still like, no, I never heard of them, so it's not a priority.
Sounds early. Yeah.
Sounds early.
Yeah.
Like, you're at that point.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking...
Which, by the way, have you noticed that it's early? Have we talked about this? And I had this conversation about like how it's early is like the code for...
It's never going to happen.
Or like, it sucks.
Funny. Yeah. That's really funny.
Yeah. And like, yeah, you just say, that's hey, really funny. Have you been in with so-and-so? They're asking about sessions for them. And then they go,
well, it's a little early.
Yeah, they go, how is it? They go, it's early.
Yeah.
You go, just like a little wink.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
But don't you feel like, see, I feel like delusion is one of the most, is very important, which is strange because on the one hand, when you see people who you think are like delusional, like certain actors you'll talk to who are doing stuff and you're like, ooh, that's dark, you know, like whatever gig they're going out for the next day.
Sure.
And you're like, dude, this dude is so far from the thing he thinks he's going for. And then you, but that's how it was. And it, so I guess what I'm saying is there are certain times when you'd be like, oh man, somebody would be doing someone a favor by waking them up and being like, dude,
yeah,
you're yeah. so far. Yeah. It's not going to happen.
Like, so far.
But you never do because delusion is important. It's the carrot that keeps you going. So when you see,
or you could call it hope.
Hope.
No, but I mean, it's sort
but of irrational. It. Right, exactly, which I guess is what hope is.
Delusions of grandeur.
Certain faith. But yeah, see, when you see your goal and you're like, I can get there in a year. And then you get to that and you're like, you realize like it was an oasis and the real thing is a whole other year.
Right.
And then it's that gradual thing that youth affords you.
Sure.
That you just keep chasing and chasing and chasing, and you get these little milestones that once you get them where you realize like aren't getting you what you need.
Sure. So what is it for you? I mean, for me, it was like I wanted that. I wanted to have a hit, you know, in multiple genres. I wanted to have.
But what was it for you?
Certain amount of
charts.
What
was it for, you were just doing band thing. You were like, this is going to be my thing.
Well, I wanted to get a record deal.
Right.
And then I wanted to go, and that happened. And then it was a terrible time in the industry, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, 2004 through 2009 when no one knows how to monetize. iTunes still hadn't even been out yet.
Right.
You know, it was like that came out basically a year into the process.
Right,
so
and they're just slashing stuff.
Yeah, and it's disorganized and they don't really know exactly what it is. And, you know, at least I could buy my album in a Virgin megastore. And that was cool.
Super cool.
You know?
Yeah.
Because... that's what I really wanted to do. I wanted to walk into a record store. I still go and buy every CD I have a song on.
Right.
I always go to Target or to Amoeba or something and buy it.
That's awesome.
Because to me, that was my goal, was to walk into a record store and buy my music.
Yeah.
And I'm still achieving it. So I have a lot of albums I've never listened to because I don't even have a CD player.
Right.
Like my computer doesn't have a CD thing
That's
anymore.
Awesome.
But I own the
CDs. You can
CDs.
Probably buy them on vinyl now. They're making everything on vinyl.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I did that with Evan the other day. We were on a break from a song, and he was like, he's got some record store around the corner. He's like, dude. He was like, when the Madonna thing had just come out, he's like, let's go in and buy all the records that we have, like the new records that we have songs
he
on.
He should.
He bought like seven. I bought like, you know.
You drop $100.
Yeah.
I don't know where to go from here. I mean, I've signed an artist. I signed a writer.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm moving towards building out, but hopefully not too fast, so I can still be a writer.
Mm. But you're building out. You're inspiring because you're building out in other forms of writing, other forms of music. I mean, you know, was fantastic, sure. And like you can do more. I want to find my version of
Wrong Man.
Not necessarily musical, but some other type of writing that's not necessarily music, some other creative sort of project. You know.
Well, I know we've talked about someday starting a musical. We should do it. But like you said, you know, people are like, oh, we should do a musical. And they don't realize that it takes 15 years to do. So when you're like, let's go in on this, this is not like a thing.
Yeah.
It's like a serious endeavor.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a pedagogical aspect to what we are doing here. And you can go and speak at universities. You can help future writers, you can help future artists understand this process so they don't make the same idiot mistakes that we made.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the evolution of anything and certainly is the music industry.
Definitely.
So, I mean, I think that's the aspiration is to actually do something that matters to the industry that has afforded me the life that I have.
Oh, that's nice. I think, yeah, that's good. Like, you have good sort of music industry, like stewardship goals, which I think is great, because I would have like killed for like if there were podcasts like this when I was starting to write,
yeah.
Oh my God, it would have meant everything. Because
yeah,
music will always be the Wild West,
right?
As far as media is concerned,
right?
It will be the always, I think, the most lawless and the most like, in good ways and bad ways.
Right.
And people will get super gangster on someone and threaten them for publishing.
Right.
Had that happen. And then, but also will be like, someone will just say, I am this, and they will be that because they said that they were. And that can lead to a lot of bullshit and can also lead to like great, you know, marvelous careers by self-made people and, you know, your Jay-Z's and all those, you know, people come from that. Anyway, it's good. I think it's necessary. We need more people.
I mean,
pushing the conversation forward.
Well, on that note, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silberstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.